From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me for an update on this week's Syrian peace talks in Switzerland.
Once you begin negotiating a ceasefire, if you leave Assad in place, you're partitioning Syria, and partition is the word that nobody wants to use.
And I'll talk with Rebecca Cruz about the escalation of violence in Ukraine.
Many people that were in the area got a very interesting text message that said, Dear subscriber, you are registered as a participant in a mass disturbance. And this only heightened the unrest there, obviously.
And later, a conversation about mother tongue-based bilingual education in Ghana with Alice Edie Gubbles.
If you are being taught in math and you don't know what 100 means, it's very difficult to have the concept of our decimal system.
That's coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott. Rebecca Cruz, welcome back to Norman after our around-the-world travels. And Joshua Landis, welcome back to the roundtable.
Good to have you back.
Thank you. So we are going to start with the big news. We've been waiting for this for some time, Joshua, and that is the Syrian peace talks. So first time ever, the Syrian opposition, the Syrian government are sitting down together. The international community is there. The world is watching. What are we expecting to happen? Because it's not going so well so far.
Well, we've got two dramatically different narratives coming out of this. John Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, opened the conference by saying Assad has to go. He cannot possibly be president of Syria anymore. The Syrian delegation said we're making jokes about the opposition, saying that Assad will run for elections in this coming year. There's supposed to be elections. And he wants to talk about terrorism and how are they going to stop terrorism, which is what he calls the rebels that he's facing. So we've got two different sides. The rebels asking for Assad to go, supported by the United States. Assad saying, no way, I'm going to run for president. I'm here. So there are big differences. This raises a question of what can you get out of this? You could get out greater movement for aid workers and perhaps some ceasefires. The problem is once you begin negotiating a ceasefire, if you leave Assad in place, you're partitioning Syria. And partition is the word that nobody wants to use. But oddly enough, the night before the meeting, the Kurds, who make up 10% of the population of Syria and have their own militia and have broken away in the very northeast, announced that they have an autonomous government. They're going to have elections in 4 months. And they weren't invited to this. They're blaming America for that and the opposition who don't want to muddy the waters with a Kurdish issue. And so they just unilaterally declared autonomy. So things are happening, but we're a long way away from any kind of a ceasefire.
So a long way away from stopping the killing. I mean, 100,000 people have been killed at least, right,
many,
in Syria at this point,
that.
More than that. So, I mean, this is atrocious. And yet Assad sits there in a position of power, really. It seems like he's been empowered through this whole thing. He's got stronger allies. He's still president. You know, what is it going to take for him to back off or to stop the killing?
Well, that is a very good question. And, you know, the whole world, once this revolution didn't go the way of Egypt or Tunisia and there wasn't a Tahrir Square moment where the government fell or the army turned against the president, everybody in the opposition looked to the United States and began to beg for intervention of some kind, whether it was through arms, through the American Air Force, giving money. And the United States refused to do it. We've intervened to a certain degree. We've given some help. But $2 billion is probably the amount of American help. You compare that to the Iraq War. At the height of the Iraq War, we were spending $2 billion in every 2 or 3 days. So President Obama basically has cut Syria loose. We have diplomacy, and that's what Kerry is trying to work on. But nobody can figure out. It's a mystery how he can say that Assad has to step down without sending F-16s to Syria.
I mean, would you say the international community has really failed in this case? I mean, they can't stop the killing. The diplomatic effort has been absolutely atrocious, that they've completely failed in this case.
Well, it's true.
Ban Ki-moon sits there, the United Nations sits there, and they're complaining about how long the speeches are going on and on. You know, I mean, is this really –
does.
You know, all the diplomatic faux pas going on during the diplomacy, and just in terms of the response to, you know, how long does the foreign minister of Syria get to speak? I mean, this just seems like crazy. Let's get to brass tacks, right? Let's talk about
how we're really going to solve this problem. The Iranians should be invited to this, and ultimately, the Iranians are the major backers of the Assad regime. The Saudis are the major backers of the rebels. Most of the money and arms going into Syria are coming from those two actors. And until they sit down and begin to agree on what's acceptable to them in Syria, their clients are going to have a hard time sitting down and agreeing.
Yeah, but the opposition said they wouldn't come if the Iranians were at the table. Right.
So that's true.
It was a requirement for the opposition to even come and partake of the discussions. The Iranians could.
What we've got so far is the admission of all sides. There has to be a political solution. Otherwise, they would not be there. If they thought they could win militarily, they wouldn't have gone to Geneva. Everybody understands at some point they're going to have to sit down and discuss. They're positioning themselves. The opposition still hopes that the United States is going to get rid of Assad for them at some level. And the Syrians still hope that Russia and they're going to come through and be able to reconquer the country. But chances are they aren't going to be. For 2 years now, we've had a stalemate. There are battle lines that are there, and most wars end when you can't, you know, you recognize you can't conquer your enemy. And we aren't there yet in Syria, but we're making steps towards that.
Well, we've been waiting to see what's going to happen, and we wait some more. So thank you, Joshua, for that. Okay, Rebecca, let's go to another part of the world, from one area of unrest to another. Ukraine is still on the front pages. We've been talking about Ukraine for some time, the fact that there's, you know, political standoff between the government of Ukraine and protesters out on the streets of Kiev, now turning violent. People are dying. People are actually arguing now that Ukraine is on the verge of civil war. What is going on here?
Well, like you said, this has been a story for some time. This started, of course, in November when decisions were made to not go towards the European Union but to look more towards Russia. And these protesters have essentially been out on the streets. And here this last week, a law was passed that severely, even more, restricted the media and put really strong limits on the ability to protest. So that obviously did not sit well with those that have been spending many cold nights out protesting. So we see an increase in violence. And in fact, we also saw an interesting thing happened this weekend. Many people that were in the area got a very interesting text message that said, "Dear subscriber, you are registered as a participant in a mass disturbance." Was unsigned, but it is expected to be from the government. And this only heightened the unrest there, obviously.
So who started the violence here, right? I mean, that's the question. Are the protesters turning violent? Is the government responding to the standoff? And what are the demands that are now being set out? So they want the government to step down. They want early elections. They want the president gone. But beyond that, what are they willing to accept? Anything? I mean, is the government just going to continue to shoot rubber bullets and tear gas at the protesters from now until eternity, until they go home?
Well, it's really tough to say where the violence started. Obviously, these things often feed upon themselves. So the government has acted very violently. The protesters are getting very frustrated. And we hear stories of old men handing rocks to protesters that are then throwing them. There's been a condemnation of the violence from the European Union, from the United States. The U.S. has, in fact, said they're going to take away some visas from Ukrainian citizens. Russia, on the other hand, has said they'll come in and stabilize the situation. So that's really where this lies. Is this country going to be going towards Europe, towards the West, or is it going to be going toward Russia? And that's really heated up. And it's anyone's guess right now where this is going to go. As you mentioned, those are the demands. The government has said that they are not going to give in to those. So we'll see. This is one of the stories we're going to have to continue to watch.
Well, Russia's definitely pointing the finger at the West.
Absolutely.
But the irony here, right, that the protesters want to be part of Europe, and yet they're using violence to get there, and the Europeans are condemning it. So it's interesting, as you said, to watch how this plays out, but definitely does not bode well for the near future.
Does not.
Well, thank you both, as always, for your analysis here on Worldviews. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you may have. Leave a comment in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. You can also get in touch with us directly at Suzette Gorlot, at Cruz226, and at Joshua_Landis. Next, I'll talk with Alice Edie Gubbles, the executive director of the Oklahoma City-based nonprofit organization, Palm Bay Ghana. I'm Suzette Gorelott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott. My guest, Alice Edie Gubbles, grew up in northern Ghana. When she started school, using her local language was forbidden, and she and her fellow pupils were only taught in English, a language completely foreign to them. This childhood experience inspired her to start the nonprofit organization, Partnership for Mother Tongue-Based Bilingual Education, in her home country, or Palm Bay, Ghana, in 2007. Alice Azumi Edie Gubbles, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've had such an interesting career and background, so many fascinating things that you've done. But one of the things you're focused on right now in your homeland of Ghana is running an organization called Palm Bay. It promotes mother tongue-based bilingual education. So this is very interesting, as we talk in the United States all the time about the importance of language immersion and being bilingual. But what is it that you're focused on? Because you're kind of looking at it from the other side, focusing on the mother tongue-based bilingual education. Why is that?
Well, language for me is really your language and culture is your identity. A lot of the rural areas, nobody speaks English. English is our official language in Ghana, yes. But many, many, many people, 70% of the population, live in rural areas, and they speak their local languages. So you start school with your local language. And from my own experience, when I started school, it was very difficult because we were supposed to speak English. And in fact, you were punished if you were caught speaking your mother tongue, your native language. And I think that made those early years very, very difficult for the children, especially, I want to say, especially in the rural areas. And so mother tongue, start with what the children come to school with. They come to school with their language. So we start with that. And then we add English. We can add other languages. We add, we don't replace.
So this seems like, you know, something so simple that you would start where the children know, you know, how to communicate so that they can move toward being bilingual. I mean, I think that's a fabulous goal, but to just, as you said, to replace it right at the first day of school, replace their language. And I mean, how confusing that must have been for you and the consequences of that, right? That kids end up being frustrated and not doing well in school and dropping out of school, right? I mean, was this your experience?
Exactly. I mean, you can sense how it is. If I start speaking Mampuruli to you, Dinyaula, Iyuri, it's just like noise. And it's very, very difficult. It's very frustrating. And research and experiences show that if you start your own language, if you are literate in your own language, then it is much easier and faster to learn other languages.
Especially at a young age, too.
Especially
talking about children
at a young age. And it helps with your other subjects. Because if you are being taught in math and you don't know what the word 100 means, it's very difficult to have the concept of our decimal system.
My guest is Alice Edie Gubbles, the founder and executive director of the Oklahoma City-based nonprofit organization Palm Bay Ghana. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorelott and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with Alice Edie Gubbles, who leads the Oklahoma City-based Partnership for Mother Tongue-Based Bilingual Education in Ghana. When we left off, she described how she and her primary schoolmates were punished if they spoke anything other than English. So how were you able to persevere through this? Because you obviously now run this organization that focuses on mother tongue bilingual education, but this was not your experience, as you mentioned. So how were you able to survive that and get to a point, because I think many of your classmates, from what I understand, did not, right? And not only that, but end up going to college and earning master's degrees and becoming a teacher. I mean, all of these things, how can you overcome such challenges?
The human being is quite resourceful. I think God gives us a lot of resources to draw on. And I had a lot of support from my father, actually, who really insisted that I continue school, even though it was very, very difficult. And a lot of my mates in the primary school dropped out. But he was really a key player in my continuation. But I always had that in mind. When I go back home and I see how my brother's children, my sister's children, there is still that struggle. And so when I came here in 2000, I came with my husband who was working with World Neighbors. And I had always had this idea, I want to go back to Ghana and do something in education. At the beginning, it was just do something in education. And so I decided to go back to school, and I went to OCU and did a master's in education. One of the areas I really wanted to explore more was this whole thing about language and culture, how they are related and how they can influence learning.
Well, it's such an accomplishment in and of itself, what you've done on your own. But then to take that knowledge and that education and go back to your home country in Ghana and start this organization and begin to educate children in a more, I guess, friendly way, right, so that they can learn more readily at that young age. But what has the reception been in Ghana? How have you been able to convince your fellow citizens in Ghana that this is the best way? How have you been able to convince the government that this is the best way to educate children in your home country?
It's very interesting. Just the time I was getting excited and going back and doing some feasibility studies about whether this is an idea that can fly in my own country. At that time, the government had also just started building a policy for like grade 1 to 3 that the language of instruction in the classroom should be the language of the area where the children come from. So we have it as a policy, but the application is still not up to scratch.
But it's interesting that the government made this change on its own. I mean, what was behind that? It was just some realization that it was that education is so critical, obviously, having an educated population that jumping immediately to a foreign language, basically, in the classroom was just not acceptable. I mean, that they had kind of come to these terms on their own.
Yes, and I think at that time, 2006, maybe 2004, actually, I think it was a USAID-supported project in two different areas in southern Ghana, because it was noticed that the comprehension level, reading and comprehension, was very, very poor. Children would be able to read, but they don't know what it is. You pronounce the words, but what do they mean? And so this pilot project was really to prove that you need to find a way for the children to learn and to understand the concept in their own language.
Right, they need to learn English as their second language.
Their second language. Yeah. So I think that research and the findings really were eye-opening, especially with development partners like USAID and the British, and actually coming to help with that kind of research. It brought the realization that it is important to start first with the first language of the children, and then you add. And when I went there, it was interesting going and talking with people about what I was trying to do. There was such a welcoming and saying yes. Because I said, look, that's what we have. We have that in our hands. So let's start with that. Let's start with that and valorize that. And then add. You can add as many as you want. But that's what we have.
To start with that mother tongue.
To start with that mother tongue.
So it made sense. It clearly made sense.
It made sense. And I visited our traditional leaders, and we had a very active advisory committee set up. There were quite a few people, older educationists, who saw this. Yes, we should do that. And yeah, the idea was. And now our district area, they come to see how we actually practice it in the classroom, because it's a policy, but the application is still.
Yeah, so like you said, the implementation of the policy, the application of the policy is still where you struggle. So finally then, what is your hope from here on out? I mean, you're just working community by community, rural area by rural area, trying to convince and show and demonstrate how and why education and the way it's delivered should be changed. And how hopeful are you that this is going to happen in what period of time?
Oh, this is interesting. Our program is like an action learning project. The Pambe Ghana supported school is called La'angum. La'angum in the local language means teamwork. And they said, we have a saying, La'angum katum, many hands make light work, in the English paraphrasing. And they said, we have worked very hard. It is our school. It's for our children. But we know that many other people far away have also contributed. So it is really an effort all of us together have come to. So La'angum is the name of that school. So there are three things. There is the mother tongue first, and then there is the hands-on approach, child-centered approach, and then the community involvement aspect of it.
Providing them ownership of that.
Of that. And they just see it as theirs, really.
Well, fascinating story, Alice. Thank you so much for being with us today on Worldviews, and best of luck to you and your community in Ghana.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Alice Edie Gubbles, the founder and executive director of Pambe Ghana. We have more information and a transcript of this interview on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorelott.